AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. Nearly 5 years after being captured in Afghanistan, Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is on his way home.
We're so thankful, and I just can't wait for Bob and Jenny to hug Bo.
Family friend and former pastor Phil Proctor. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the goal was to get Bergdahl to safety.
It was our judgment that if we could find an opening and move very quickly with that opening, that we needed to get him out of there, essentially to save his life.
The indirect negotiations through Qatar resulted in 5 senior Taliban figures being freed from Guantanamo. Hagel, who is in Afghanistan, tells U.S. troops that they still have an important job to do as they work toward the day the last combat forces leave that country.
The American people want our job finished here, but they want it finished the right way. And you want to finish it the right way. The President of the United States, I want to finish it the right way. And I think we're on a path to do that.
Earlier, Hagel met with the Special Forces team that brought Bergdahl back to safety. The co-owner of the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper, Lewis Katz, is one of 7 people killed in a fiery crash of a private jet on takeoff from an airfield near Boston last night. 6 climbers are thought dead on Mount Rainier in Washington State.
Helicopters detected pings from emergency beacons buried in the snow. Ranger Fawn Bauer says climbing gear was spotted thousands of feet below the group's last known location.
Every indication was that there was not a viable chance of survival after a fall.
No recovery plans are in place.
There's an area of constant ice and rock fall in that area, which causes great danger.
The missing group includes 4 clients of Seattle-based Alpine Ascents International and 2 guides. I'm Ed Donahue.
This is AP Radio News. Hall of Fame golfer Phil Mickelson says he's done nothing wrong and is cooperating with FBI agents investigating insider trading. Federal officials says the FBI and Securities and Exchange Commission are looking into trades Mickelson and Las Vegas gambler Billy Walters made involving Clorox at the same time that investor Carl Icahn was trying to buy the company. AP golf writer Doug Ferguson reports that the PGA may have another problem with Mickelson's dealings with Walters.
The greater concern, and we'll see where this goes, is what kind of relationship Phil has with one of the world's most famous gamblers. I think that could be probably the greater concern of the PGA Tour than any type of federal investigation.
It's on to the finals for the San Antonio Spurs after they knock off Oklahoma City Thunder 112-107 overtime last night to win the Western Conference Finals in the NBA, setting up a championship rematch with the Miami Heat. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast, and we want you to join us at Great Taste of Tyson's on Saturday, May 31st.
Join us at 3 p.m. for a live blind beer tasting with the pros. Everybody gets a sip of beer, and everybody gets to decide what kind it is. We'll be with DC Brow, 3-Star Brewery, and Teddy Folkman.
Can't join us? We're recording the show, and you're going to hear it Sunday, June 1st at 11 a.m. right here on 1500 a.m.
What do you want to be when you're older?
When I'm older, I want to be a singer. That's my goal.
An organizer of like do-gooders.
I want to be a media mogul.
When I'm older, I want to be anything but the one that doesn't fit in, the one that people don't love.
Everyone deserves a dream.
But some of us are depressed,
anxious,
angry,
scared,
don't feel like ourselves.
If that's you, say something.
Talk to someone. People will listen.
Add your voice at OKToTalk.org.
OKToTalk.org. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership.
Of Mayorga Coffee. Martin, what is Mayorga Coffee?
Mayorga Coffee today is essentially a company that sources and imports coffee from small cooperatives throughout Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Small farmers throughout Latin America that are focused on organic coffees, and our goal is to be market makers for them throughout the U.S. market.
And how big or small is the company?
We're about 50 staff, and last year we did about $22 million in sales.
Mm-hmm. And when did you guys get started?
I ultimately started it in 97, but I was dabbling in the industry in about 94.
Dabbling in the industry in 94. What was going on in 94 for you?
Well, in 94 was really when I started becoming interested in the supply chain side of coffee, which was really why I started the business, was to help a family friend have better access to the market and have a better opportunity to make a living by selling his coffee into the U.S. roasters rather than through the supply chain that doesn't provide opportunity for farmers.
And this wasn't here in the United States?
This was in the U.S. I actually was fortunate enough to move here when I was 12, and I got to go to high school and college here as well.
And how did you know anything about coffee?
I didn't. I knew about supply chain. I knew about inefficiencies. I think I was young and naive enough to see a supply chain that was antiquated, oppressive, and inefficient. And, I was young and daring enough to try to make a change.
Young and daring. Where does a young and daring young man get the confidence to go pull something like this off?
I think ultimately my background of having lived in so many places, I was born in Guatemala, lived through, I think, the second worst earthquake in the Western Hemisphere, in the history of the Western Hemisphere. We moved to Nicaragua, where I lived through a revolution. Part of my hobbies was collecting bullet shells in the morning after the gunfights.
Goodness.
Lived there and moved to Costa Rica, and then from Costa Rica went to Peru, and then came to the U.S. via Miami.
What was that like growing up for you like that?
It's interesting because I tell people that as a child, everything is normal to you because that's your only point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
It did not become unique, distinct, or different until I was growing up. And I think that was my challenging years really were, coming here at 12 years old, having a very different background in an area that was not diverse, in an area that did not have much experience with the kind of places where I grew up and spent my time. So
how did you fit in? What did you do to fit in, or didn't you?
I didn't to some degree, and I did to others. I think part of what suffered mostly was my academic success, or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
I think the not being able to really be who I was and really kind of feel right anywhere.
What do you mean by that?
I had to learn English. I think I got in a lot of fights over people picking on me for not speaking English.
Yeah.
And then just everybody already had their friends. They had their friends that they knew from elementary school and different places. And even when we moved here, we moved around a lot. So we didn't have stability, and I didn't have that core group of friends. And when I was in junior high, it was one or two other Hispanic kids in the whole class, so it wasn't, you couldn't really relate to many people.
So what kept you going?
When I was younger, I loved baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So I played baseball, I was good at it. That really, I think, gave me some confidence and identity.
From an American perspective, or?
Yeah, totally from an American perspective, from a social side. I think, being the youngest of four, I had to find a way to stand out, and I had a good sense of humor, and I carried that with me, and I think, mm-hmm. Got me along. And, I've just always been a pretty easygoing guy. So I think ultimately I was able to assimilate into different areas and different cultures and relationships.
And how do you think that actually helps you today in terms of how you run your company?
I think ultimately it allows me to focus on what matters and gives me a purpose. And that purpose is really what drives me and what drives our company. Mm-hmm. And I think having a purpose-driven company, purpose-driven leadership, just gives us so much clarity in doing what we do for the right reasons and making smart decisions and making decisions, again, that are courageous and mm-hmm. decisions that go against the grain and not being afraid of competing against, you know, multi-billion dollar companies and sitting at the table with, you know, large retailers, multinationals, because we believe in what we do.
Mm-hmm. So how young were you when you realized that purpose was important to what you were doing?
You know, I think it was, you know, it's like a movie when you they play sequences back and everything starts mm-hmm. to make sense. Mm-hmm. I think for me it happened really after 91, 92 when I started going back to Nicaragua.
Uh-huh.
You know, I one of my first very vivid recollections was going to the market with my mom in Guatemala, buying all our foods that we needed for the week, and it was a lot of food because there was four kids and mm-hmm. a lot of mouths to feed.
This is when you were younger.
I was very young. Yeah. I was mm-hmm. about 4 years old.
Uh-huh.
And we were leaving the market, and a little boy and his mom came to us and looked very destitute. It was almost, like I said, it's like a strange mirror to look into. The little boy was about my height, my age. The mother almost looked like my mom's age, and mm-hmm. they had nothing, and here we were with everything we could ever want. And then going back to Nicaragua, after these years of being here, trying to fit in and struggling and thinking that I had real struggles,
yeah.
and going back there and remembering what real struggle was all about,
mm-hmm.
I think it kind of brought it all home to me.
You said something in the green room earlier about this experience in particular of how fortunate you were and what 50 feet made the difference. And can you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it ultimately, I looked at people a lot differently after that. And I realized that I did nothing to be born in the family that I was born into. My family wasn't wealthy. I mean, my parents didn't own a home until I was in college, and they struggled financially. But I had opportunities, and I think that was a big differentiator.
You had opportunities. You weren't totally disillusioned at all.
Right. I think opportunity was what defined me and what still defines me. And what I understood to be that great difference between this country and so many other countries where I've seen people that really don't have opportunities, and their lot in life is their lot in life generationally. And here, if you work hard and you don't even have to be that smart. You know, you just work hard and you get lucky and you have people support you and you have good ethics. There's a lot of opportunity in this country.
What were your mom and dad doing with all this change and shift and move? What were their...
You know, I think my dad ultimately, his goal and his dream was always to help his people in Nicaragua. He left Nicaragua at 16, which was, again, a very courageous move. He realized that to do anything productive and forward moving in his life, he had to come to the U.S. and learn English.
Mm-hmm.
So he was still finding his way. You know, he had a background where during the revolution and the Cold War and everything going on in the 80s, he couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So he struggled his whole life finding his place and his identity and his mark on doing the right thing for his country.
And how did that affect you?
You know, I think ultimately it affects me now in the fact that I respect and appreciate that. And maybe I didn't even see that before when I was younger. It makes me really have a lot of respect for the fact that he believed in something bigger than him. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he educated himself, he took risks,
mm-hmm.
and really leveraged that to the best that he could to do something better for his country.
Is he surprised about what you're doing now with your life?
Well, he passed away in 2009, and he was excited. I mean, he was...
So he got to see your success.
He did, and he was very intrigued, excited, and you know, he had some good advice, having been in business and done business in Latin America. You know, he gave me good insights, and he definitely was excited about the fact that I was going back there and trying to do something productive.
Mm-hmm. I get the sense that what really drives you, though, is the sense of fairness, the fair trade, that there's a process here that the business is a conduit for.
I think ultimately, yes. You know, again, I don't know if it's manifested itself until recently, but ultimately I do think that, you know, in life, and it's that 50 feet difference, you know, I didn't do anything special, and I don't think anybody on this earth has done anything more special than any other person until they really have done something more special.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I believe in that.
I think the word you used was equity.
Definitely. I think, you know, and
I think that's what Colin was mm-hmm. referring yeah. to, yeah.
And that's really the backbone of what we do and what really makes us very successful and what makes us sit at a table with a Costco and, you know, major national companies who could sit in front of any manufacturer, importer, roaster, and we're differentiated because we understand equity goes from the farmer to the consumer.
So what do you think is better, cooperation or competition?
Man, that's a tough one. You know, I don't know if it's my midlife crisis or what, but you know, I love competition. I think competition makes us great, but I've learned to really appreciate being my own best competitor. I do believe in cooperation, and I do believe in bringing the best out of people. You know, we're here obviously in a show about leadership. I think leading people and working with people who evolve and grow and contribute is one of the most energizing ways to manage a business. And that, to me, is more powerful than competition. Being better for myself and for the people that support me is more powerful than trying to beat somebody or trying to be better than somebody else.
Mm-hmm. You said something earlier, too, about the first job you had, which actually required you to leave school. It was a cigar business. Can you give us that condensed short version of what was that about and what happened in there that kind of had a huge influence on what you are today, who you are today, and the way you lead?
Sure. Well, technically, my first job started very young. I was always very motivated by independence, and sometimes you need money to be independent.
Yeah.
Ultimately, going back to Nicaragua and really remembering and even just the smells, the feel, everything about being back in Nicaragua made me want to be back doing business there and contributing. And I started the cigar business and really learned some great lessons from who became my mentor eventually, which is Lou Rothman, who founded JR Cigars, and really reinforced that equity concept to me. And he was obviously very successful at it, so I think I replicated a lot of that.
Excellent. What's the website address?
www.mayorgacoffee.com.
We've been speaking with Martin Mayorga, founder and president of Mayorga Coffee. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview. And don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offit Kerman. What is Offit Kerman, Doug?
Offit Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region, with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tyson's Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work with in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener. And I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into two particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease. And the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying, and since then he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options, and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offitkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offit Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Mark Cohn of Opti4 and Colin Callahan of Callahan & Associates. For this segment, we've got Brian Koester, CEO of Koester VMS. Welcome, Brian.
Welcome.
Brian, what is Koester VMS?
Koester VMS is a nationwide appraisal management and technology company that serves the mortgage banking community.
And how big or small is it?
About $30 million in revenue, about 80 employees.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get a job with them?
Started it. So
when did you start it?
Hired myself back in 2007.
And what was going on for you back then that said, this is a good time to start a business, 2007?
Yeah, well, timing is everything, and I mistimed that. I started off just as an appraiser, so it was just the me working as an appraiser, residential real estate appraiser. So,
and did you get the idea that I can do this with more people?
It kind of happened organically, where we had some clients. I was, you know, appraising in just a small geographic area. We had some clients that were out of state that said, "Hey, why don't you, you know, can you take on additional work for me in areas that you didn't cover?" And I found people to do it, and that grew into states and regions, and then eventually the whole country.
So you really didn't start out, "I think I'm going to build a firm nationwide. This is what I'm going to do."
No, not at all. No, no, it was accidental to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think it is about you that enabled you to actually do this and do this successfully?
Work ethic is a lot to do with it, as well as just the whole idea of, you know, everyone's trying to figure it out. Everyone's trying to do the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do it. Believe in yourself, confidence, reading, those types of things really, really enabled me to do it. I mean, I never thought I couldn't do it. So there's no question about, you know, you wouldn't be able to do this, or, you know, you're not big enough to do this. I always thought, like, all right, well.
Where's the confidence come from?
I don't know. Just got it, right? Some people got it. I don't know. It's just... So over-preparing is a lot of it. I think if you're really prepared, you really know your stuff, you read all the books, you're totally prepared, you're really, really confident. I mean, it's just as simple as in school.
So where did the necessity for over-preparing come for you as a kid?
I don't know. I just always thought you're supposed to be prepared. It was something where, you know, you show up on time, you do what you're supposed to do, and... You read and you did what you were supposed to do. I didn't think anything of it. I mean, honestly.
Is there someone that actually you learned that from?
I think my father had a lot to do with that.
What was that?
He was an overall real estate hustler to a certain extent. I mean, he was an appraiser. He was sold some real estate, did some things like that.
Did he have his own company?
Yeah, self-employed, just him.
Okay. Did you go out and work with him as a kid?
I followed him around and sit in the car during the summer.
Uh-huh.
You know, we drive around with him, and you know, it's just like things like that. Yeah.
What do you think you learned from all that time with your dad?
You know, he was a little different of a guy, so I think that you know, I never forget one time where, you know, he would get up at, you know, 4 a.m. and all the time, actually. And he told me, and he goes, you know, if you just get it over with tomorrow, you're going to forget about it. So, you know, work hard and just do that type, you know, work hard, work through the pain, work through the tiredness, and just, you know, tomorrow you can sleep all day kind of thing.
How did that show up in the development of your business, that grinding?
That most people really aren't able to grind it out.
Uh-huh.
Like, most people are in the office, let's say, but in the office is like in your bed. Like, you may not be sleeping, well, you may not be working.
Right.
Doing 30, 40 meetings a day, you know, not for a week, for 2 years, 3 years, you know, doing things like that, which seem ridiculous, but you can do relatively easily if you just put the effort forward. Is things that we did.
Yeah. And were you driving towards a specific goal while you were working at that pace?
You know, so playing football and doing those types of things, you know, I think within everybody's heart there's something that you kind of leave on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if you've ever played sports, or anyone who's ever tried and ran a business, you always look back and you think, you know, if I could do it over again, I'd do so much more. I'd do this, I'd do that. I don't have that anymore. And that's because of that work ethic where I just wanted to leave it off, just, you know, completely done.
Yeah, you told us in the green room that you didn't start sports as the top man in the football.
No, I was horrible. So 10th grade, I went out for football just because I was kind of big or tall. And I didn't play at all. Zero. Like, I got one game for two plays kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that was because it was half 100 at halftime.
So your height didn't guarantee you a slot on the field?
No. I was the least of athleticism. But through working out, through, you know, running and doing all those types of things, which, you know, seem like the natural thing to do. If you're going to play football, you got to do these types of things. Mm-hmm. I was able to become good. I was all state and all American and went to the University of Tennessee to play football.
So you start out not being good necessarily. You're not even a starter when you begin. what kept you going? You could have easily just walked away.
I saw results as far as work, from the work, mm-hmm. meaning like when you go to the gym, you start working out and you start seeing you get better. And you say, okay, well, if I get stronger, then obviously I'll be better. And then it's you run and then you get faster. Well, if I'm stronger and bigger, I'll get faster, and then I'll be better. And then you realize that it wasn't necessarily you that was the issue. It's that you didn't have the proper skill sets to become that. And a lot of guys got that, you know, growing up or from another capacity. So it was really simple, like, if you do this, you'll be good.
So work hard and develop and...
Well, do what you're supposed to do. So football players that are good work out, do what they're supposed to, you know, work out, run, train. Business guys that are good, they do meetings, they, you know, mm-hmm. they read and they work hard. Like,
so
it's
there's a lot of little things you do day in, day out that build the skills is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
So how does that show up in today in leading your company? What's that look like in your leadership style?
So, you know, as a leader, we're very forward thinking. We're very innovative in the industry. And I think it's about all doing all the little things right. Mm-hmm. So our level of detail that we go into with things is pretty insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty insane, the level of detail that we go into when dealing with customers or solicitation or sales and operations. And I think everybody does the big things. So everyone, when it comes to business, does the big things. They show up, they return your email, they return a phone call. But when it comes to the little, tiny, almost too short, you know, too small to notice, mm-hmm. type things, that's where you really win, because cumulatively they make a huge difference. You know, one by one, you know, there's not that big a deal whether that, you know, somebody logs every phone call or logs every email or, you know, grades every customer's interaction,
but
or
cumulatively
it makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm.
So there's an aspect of, I guess, what people are calling big data, but you're picking it up by little bits of data.
We have the little data and the big data. Mm-hmm. We actually have both. But just doing everything possible. Mm-hmm. So every avenue.
What did you learn from your mom that shows up in your leadership style?
My mom's very different. My mom is an accountant. She's smart. That's funny because my dad's.
That's okay.
You my dad's to, care. My mom. Correct my now. Mom's charismatic, and I mean, my mom's reserved and smart. My dad's charismatic and dumb. it's true. You know, he'll admit that. No, he's actually a great guy, but different kind of smart. But I would say that I got something very similar from both of them. Just mm-hmm. a good work ethic, good values, good things like that.
And when you sit down to hire somebody, how do you know you have a good employee? What are you looking for?
So we don't hire anybody for a position. We hire them for a future position. And what that means is that they can go face-to-face with a client. We want them to be able to go face-to-face with a client eventually, so they can meet with the CEO of the major bank eventually. Yeah. And if they can't do that, then it's one of these things where there's really no point. You're like renting somebody instead of buying them, right, to a certain extent.
Right.
Right. We got to wrap this up. So, Brian, what's the website address?
It's www.coastervms.com.
Thanks, Brian. We've been speaking with Brian Coaster, CEO of Coaster VMS. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview. And don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
We work, our clients say that it's the three Ps, our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified, and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is perhaps, the perfect client for you?
businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smollett, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Mark Cohn. For this segment, we've got Chris McGough, founder of The Clearing. Welcome, Chris. Chris, what is The Clearing?
Clearing is a consulting company in Washington, D.C. Executives come there to get themselves aligned, clear about their future.
And how big or small is it?
50 people, small business, services, command and control support, and it's just a very interesting watching leaders really work. So I have a feeling that collaboration is important when it's used correctly, but it can be misused by leaders who don't want to take a stand and be brave.
Hmm. So let's go back a little bit in your growing up. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I'm still growing up in Silver Spring, Maryland.
So you're from Scranton. Brothers and sisters?
Yep. I have two sisters and a brother. I was the second of four. And
Second oldest?
Second oldest of four, yes.
Uh-huh. And what were mom and dad doing?
Well, my father was a fourth-generation funeral director, and my mother was his number one employee. They ran the place by themselves. And
so they worked together?
They worked together every day. Mm-hmm.
And you said that actually the funeral home was in the house?
Yes, it was. It was downstairs in the house.
Can you
very
give us a sense
very
of,
short
what's that
commute
like?
For Washingtonians?
Yeah, what's that like?
Well, it just becomes part of your life there. You know, it's like growing up with a father who's a pastor. You know, it's just what you do, and it's what goes on in your house.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but it's not all that common to grow up in a house where downstairs is a funeral home. So how old were you when you just realized there's something very special about where I'm growing up in this house that's going on?
I think it was after I left it, to be honest with you, when I went into engineering and I looked back and thought, that was different. But I got into the business, my brother and I got into the business as soon as we could lift a body. And we got big into the business when we got our driver's licenses.
So you were actually working in the business?
I am a licensed funeral director in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Can I give you my card?
That's amazing.
So as a youngster, you were growing up with this as part of your environment.
A fish doesn't know there's water.
Mm-hmm. And you were telling us in the green room about watching your dad as he came into those situations where people were grieving. And what did you learn from him as you watched that?
Yeah, this came up later. I really appreciated something that he taught me. We would be driving to a death call in these houses that we'd go to sometime in the middle of the night. And after watching him for a long period of time, I realized that he was balancing. If we walked into a house full of chaos where mm-hmm. people were running around and crying and screaming, he would bring them to the kitchen table and maybe open up a little bottle of whiskey and get them to talk about the deceased mm-hmm. and trying to bring them back into some level of order. But if we walked into a house where everybody was heads down, just, you know, really sad, he would give them work to do and try to bring some life to that house. And it was only after like working with him for many years where I realized he became what they needed. He mm-hmm. walked in the door, read quickly, and then adjusted his whole way of being to be for those people what he thought they needed. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating to watch, and it really informed, you know, my professional mm-hmm. life.
Yeah, because as you were saying, what you bring then to consulting is quite similar. Tell us about that.
You know, when you build a business, you want it to be as standard as possible. But the standard that The Clearing operates from is, and we're not always perfect at this. A lot of it depends on like golf and how we're feeling that day. But what we really want to do is what Bob McGough did. We want to meet people where they are and, you know, give them what they can take at that time. And that varies from case to case.
You know what strikes me about something? It just hit me, and maybe this is what resonates with you as well. The funeral business is not an easy business, but it's real. And you talk about the work you do, about the conversations you have, and having read your book, you know, The Primes. about creating a space for those hard conversations to have. I mean, socially complex, technically complex kinds of problems.
Yeah.
There's nothing more difficult than dealing with the very reality of what you did growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you see that connection between that and what you're doing now.
Yeah, I really do. I think being in a relationship with a wife or significant other, having children, and running a business, the main thing that's happening there is an assault on yourself, a confrontation with yourself. If you want to run a business in this type of environment, the one thing that's going to happen is you're just going to have to take yourself on.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead,
Mike. So how did you get from engineering to life coaching?
I don't do life coaching. That's the last thing in the world I can do. I don't want to present myself that way. I could use a life coach. But when I was at IBM, I ended up taking over their collaborative technology development pre-Lotus Notes. Mm-hmm. And, well, I'll tell you something. We knew the technology at IBM, but we did not understand groups. And so I had to get really smart on groups really, really fast. And so once I really learned that the unit that now can take the problems on that this nurse is facing is not the individual, it's the group. That's the smallest unit that can solve problems now. And there wasn't a lot of group literacy. I still don't think there's a lot of group literacy. Mm-hmm. So I left technology and focused entirely on group dynamics.
Hmm. And growing up as a kid, how did that prepare you for the group dynamic aspects?
You know, a death is a group experience, and everything is going to come out in that moment in time. It's raw. Well, businesses, especially in this recession, they are raw, and everything's coming out. You know, profit and growth covers a lot of the problems in a business. When they're growing, boy, you can do just about anything. But when they're in the squeeze right now, of the 10 fastest shrinking companies, 7 are in our area right here.
Mm-hmm.
And those managers and leaders in there are facing everything right now. They're very, very, it's like powder kegs. And I think they're very much like the death and dying experience. It's very raw, very, you know, people are saying what they need to say. It's tough to be a leader right now in this market.
Yeah.
Very tough.
Obviously, your growing up experience was very formative. Did you have other mentors along the way?
Yeah, my big mentor right now is my wife, Claire, 31 years. And what I really appreciate is that as I'm an older man now, 56 years old, I have people that have known me for 40 years and 45 years. And there's nothing like that, you know, longitudinal relationship if you really want to understand yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And she continues to teach me with persistence and patience and discipline. And I value her tremendously, and also, you know, all the writings of Jesus Christ.
She doesn't work with you, though.
She works with me every night at home. I'm in a very loving way. No, we do keep it separate. She's an accomplished poet, and so we have a very different kind of life. But I think complimentary. I hope she would think so.
What about Mom? I mean, Colin was heading in a direction here. I just want to pick up on it. Your mom, you had some interesting thoughts to share about your mom and the influence that she had on you as well. Can you share them with us?
I think me, like many people, my mother grew up she was born in 29, and she was the second youngest of 7. Mother died very early, and the father went out of town to work. So these kids were alone, and they were scrapping, and they were really scrapping. And it's more than a work ethic. It's a survival ethic. And now that I'm older, I can see that in me. It's a drive that you have even beyond the point of necessary. You know, you just don't, there's no stopping rule. It's built into you, and you just keep driving and driving and driving. That's what I'm starting to question right now about myself. Really, is this drive that's gotten me here, is that the one I want to ride out? And I'm not sure.
Yeah. That's an interesting question to kind of confront yourself with, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you said something also that you know, she, I think to paraphrase a little bit, she had a strong back. I mean, she went through a whole lot to get where she was.
You bet.
She raised a family of what, 4 kids?
And a chronically ill daughter, very early diagnosed with lupus. And so my mother became almost an expert on lupus and a very distrustful person on hospital systems back in the 1960s.
Wow.
So she had the rule, no one goes into a hospital is ever alone if they're in our family.
Huh.
And, you know, she was just a very strong person, never finished high school, but she just had this strength. And she can walk into a hospital setting and get everyone to listen to her almost instantly because she basically kept my sister alive for a long, long time. And we watched her do that. She was fearless in working with people that were so much more educated than her and so much more language with her. And she disregarded it all and said, well, tell me in my words exactly what's going on here. I think that's where I got the name, you know, the clearing. I mean, she just, if you can't tell it to me clearly, then it's your fault, not mine.
Is that where it comes from?
I don't know. I made that up.
So, but what did you take away from that experience, or your mom, the lesson that she kind of ingrained in?
I think the one thing is that people use really fancy and complicated words when they actually don't know what they're saying, because she really keeps things simple. Mm-hmm. And if she can't understand it, it's not her fault. And I think that as you get older as a consultant, you start to use much simpler words. Mm-hmm. And you just, you don't hide behind three syllable things and that kind of thing. I think I learned that from her. You know, be a straight communicator. Be clear with me.
Mm-hmm. It's a great place.
Tell me what's going on.
It's a great place to end here. What's the website address, Chris?
The website is theclearing.com.
Thanks, Chris. We've been speaking with Chris McGough, founder of The Clearing. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, and Mark Cohn for helping with the interview. And don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn & Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn & Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients. That's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohn & Burnett?
CohnAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A and D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Mark Cohn. For this segment, we've got Stephen Fradkin, president of Intiva. Welcome, Stephen. Stephen, what is Intiva?
Intiva is a full IT solution provider that specializes in IT support for small, medium-sized businesses and nonprofit organizations.
And how big or small is the company?
Intiva is about a $15 million company with approximately 80 employees.
How'd you get started with it?
We started in the late 2004 when I had actually been doing this as a sole proprietor for many years and was prompted by a contractor that I had at the time who had four wives and a kid. who had a wife and four kids and was spending a lot of time helping me out on weekends and evenings and also had another full-time job. We kind of put in a position where I had to decide, hey, are we going to do this full throttle or are we going to continue to make this a very small side gig?
Was it something that you had inside you that said, I can do this? Or is it something that someone saw in you that said, go, shoot, this, make this thing work?
To be honest, yeah. Every day I question whether or not I can do this. But I do know that at the end of the day, with enough work and really effort, we can do anything that we put our minds to. Mm-hmm. So.
But presidents and owners of companies are supposed to be really confident. What do you mean you question that?
I'm confident in our people, and I'm confident in the fact that if we provide the right level of support and response time and create an environment that is going to allow our people to grow and develop, that at the end of the day, we'll be able to solve technology problems and implement solutions that no one else can do.
That's a lot of lessons in there.
There's a lot of lessons.
Where did you learn those lessons?
You know, it comes back from a lot of experiences that I've had. My mother ran and continues to run a boutique optical firm called Village Eye Center out in the D.C. metro area.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always done this, and she's had an incredible work ethic, and she's worked with very high-end people and helped them see better and do amazing things with her business, and she gave that her all. I watched my father do the same thing with an accounting firm for over 40 years in the DC metro area. So I was kind of born and bred with that mentality. And when I...
So what's that mentality? Is it an entrepreneurial mentality or a can-do? Or
I think it's a combination of being able to attack the world and achieve the goals you want to achieve. And in my case, it was really a desire to grow a solid technological firm that can provide solutions to people's problems. And that's what we've done.
Mm-hmm. How young were you when you first realized that independence was important to you?
So very early. Mm-hmm. So it was probably 8 or 9 years old. And while my parents were excellent role models, they had me follow their rules. So, mm-hmm. so if I didn't do it to their vision of perfection, mm-hmm. then it was not going to be acceptable. The way I found out that I could get past that was by starting to generate my own income and, uh-huh. and be able to do things on my own. And that started me off very early doing everything from working in ice cream shops to actually forging a license so I could be young not to buy booze or uh-huh. or anything like that, but actually to get a job before I probably was legally able.
Uh-huh.
So really had that drive and work ethic early. Also,
was that a work ethic or was it just a path to independence?
You know, I actually think it was both. The path to independence required the work ethic. The work ethic stuck. Mm-hmm. So that was really what I focused on as a child, is just getting it done.
And then you started your first business that became Intiva when you were in middle school.
Tell
us about that.
That's right. So in addition to the strong work ethic, I realized that technology was really cool, and not only can being a geek have, you know, be a fun experience and get to touch and play with cool things, mm-hmm. it also was a path to solving problems and a path to good business. Ultimately, I was in a CompUSA being a geek at about 12 years old, and was wearing a red shirt and kind of in the right place at the right time. Somebody mistook me for an employee, uh-huh. started asking me questions. I answered them, and ultimately he asked me to go to his home to help him get set up. I did that, and he wound up being a very wealthy local entrepreneur with many, many employees, a huge, huge company, and he brought me into his company to help him, as well as started referring me to other wealthy residential clients in the DC metro area.
And what do you think he saw in you?
I think he saw someone that understood technology, which was something he knew was important to his life and his business, but mm-hmm. had no idea what to do with.
But he had all these people in the store he could have asked. Why do you think he asked you?
I think there was a level of trust. He asked me to join and help his company because he felt that the people he had in his IT department, while they were possibly qualified, there were things that he didn't want them to see or to share as he ran his organization.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about you that said, I can do that?
You know, I just saw an opportunity and I ran with it. To be honest, I didn't think I could do it.
Did he offer you a full-time job there, or were you just sort of an outside consultant?
Well, I was helping out in his residence, and he started referring me to more residential clients. So that was me as a consultant. And he offered me a position as an intern over the summer. I was only 13 at the time, so I went in as an intern in that IT department and did that between school.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Wow. The technology part is one piece, obviously, that you brought to the game. But there's also something here about building relationships. Where did you learn that, and when did that become important?
You know, I have to think back to the first time that really I realized relationship building was important, and I'll attribute that to my father. Mm-hmm. It's about 6 years old at a fairly large philanthropic event with maybe 600 attendees, uh-huh. and he pulled me in the corner and he said, I'll give you $1 for every person's hand you shake. So I spent the next 3 hours going and shaking 220 people's hands, uh-huh. and I remember that to the day, and uh-huh. and those are relationships that started. And, you know, to this day, I've valued that, and having those relationships are important.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier you came from comfortable settings, and yet it sounds like money is important. Can you kind of put money in perspective for us in terms of what it means to you?
I find money to be important to allow hurdles to be removed from life.
What do you mean?
So I can achieve what I want to achieve. I can do what I want to do if I don't have to think about how I'm going to pay my rent or buy food or what to do for my child's education, for mm-hmm. example. So having enough to do that is all that's really important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So everything else that's associated with worrying about how to get that money gets out of the way. And when that's out of the way, I find that I can solve problems a lot better if things like that don't exist. So as we've grown in Teva, one of our big focuses have been to try to get those things out of the way and develop people's autonomy and ability to grow without having to worry about living paycheck to paycheck.
Mm-hmm. So that aspect of security is in that context then. It's a form of a foundation to be able to do the things that need to be do, get that out of the way, and you free yourself up to do a whole lot of different things.
That's right.
Is Antiva the first company you started?
Actually, no. There were a few, but before Antiva, as I was doing this really since about 1994, it was called Custom Computer Creators, and it was just me operating as a sole proprietor, predominantly supporting residential clients. It was about 2001 that those residential clients brought me into more commercial settings, and frankly, those relationships that I had then, I still have today, and I can attribute a lot of what I learned in terms of what mistakes to avoid, what successes to duplicate from watching these local business leaders and what they've done in their companies.
Are you more like your mom or your dad?
I think I'm a pretty good combination of both, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, they both have taught me a lot in terms of how to build relationships, how to care about the community, how to give back to the community, mm-hmm. and really how to stick with what they are doing. I watch lots of other people now that jump from different jobs to different careers to all sorts of different things because they can, which is wonderful, but yeah. They taught me to stick with one thing and really focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Does your success surprise them at all?
I don't think it does. I really don't think it does.
Okay. What's the website?
The website is antiva.com. That's N as in Nancy, T as in Tom, I as in Igloo, V as in Victor, A as in Alpha.com.
Thanks, Stephen. We've been talking with Stephen Fradkin, president of Antiva.
We had a great lineup of guests today. We started with Martin Magora, a founder and president of Magora Coffee.
Mayorga.
And then we had Brian Koester, CEO of Koester VMS, Chris McGough, founder of The Clearing, and finally, Stephen Fradkin, president of Antiva.
This is your host, Les Smolin, and I'd like to thank my co-hosts, Colin Callahan and Mark Cohn, for helping with the interview, hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. And I'd like to thank our listening audience for listening, otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can also hear this program again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. First, she'll crawl. Then take her first baby steps. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school. I'll be watching her run down a soccer field. Staying up all night waiting for her to get home from her first date. Wincing when she steps on the gas pedal and then the brakes. Beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma. Or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle.
But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Gather your family, friends, and coworkers and join March for Babies to help make her steps possible. March for Babies! Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
I can't believe it. I lost my house, my wife, my family, and my job. Everything.
If you or someone you know has tried but can't stop gambling, you should know that problem gambling could be an addiction.
While gambling is entertainment for some people, for over 150,000 people in Maryland, it's a devastating medical condition.
Are you at risk? Call the Maryland Center on Problem Gambling Helpline, 1-800-GAMBLER, or go to mdproblemgambling.com. We can help.
Today, you ate Greek yogurt. You took the train. You wondered why people spend so much time reading celebrity blogs. You read a celebrity blog. You planned a workout. You skipped it. You did all the things that one normally does the day before a devastating earthquake shakes the community to the ground. You never know when the day before is the day before. Prepare for...
Do you know a woman who exemplifies leadership and is making a difference in our community? Then nominate her today to receive an award at the March of Dimes Heroines of Washington Gala. Finalists will be recognized at a Black Tie Awards presentation on November 18th. All proceeds will benefit the March of Dimes mission to give all babies a healthy start in life. To learn more about the March of Dimes and Heroines of Washington, visit marchofdimes.com/DC.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
For 45 years, people have relied on Village Green Apothecary to give them individualized nutrition, pharmacy, and healthy living products. Village Green will give you the kind of person-to-person help and attention that mass-market pharmacies have long ago forgotten. You can depend on us for knowledge, experience, product selection, and a smile. Visit Village Green in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane. Call us at 301-530-0800 or check out our website at myvillagegreen.com. We're here to help you.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Essentials of Healthy Living here on AM 1500, brought to you by the Village Green Apothecary. I am your host for today, Dr. Kevin Passero. Thank you all for tuning in every week. I get tons of great feedback from people who listen to the show. Let us know they're thankful that we're here as a resource, and I really certainly do appreciate that feedback. So thank you again for tuning in. We're here every Sunday from 10 to 11 a.m. trying to bring you the latest and greatest related to health and wellness to help you live healthier, happier lives, sharing with you great information and great research in the world of medicine, specifically as it relates to more integrative, holistic therapies, which I believe are truly the future of medicine. Or a huge part of the future of medicine. Today, we're going to be talking about an incredibly important and popular topic. I'm inundated with these questions every single day in my office, and this is the issue related to bone density and bone health. We're going to be talking about some specific nutrients later in the show, as we always try and highlight about helping to support bone health, and we're going to be talking in general about what does bone health mean. When we discuss the idea of bone health, of course, our
concern, at least the majority of concern when it comes to bone health, has to do with bone fracture risk. And this is mainly in the population of older people. We're talking about postmenopausal women is the biggest category of people that are at risk for bone fractures. And we know this is a serious issue. It's not just about the discomfort or pain of a bone fracture, but these bone fractures can be very, very significant, specifically the ones related to hip fractures. Hip fractures, the statistics amongst hip fractures are quite scary. You know, elderly people who have a hip fracture, there's a high percentage of death rate within 5 years after a hip fracture. It's a very difficult process to recover from. It leads to a sedentary lifestyle. It leads to other medical interventions, surgeries, and it actually significantly decreases some aspects of life expectancy after a hip fracture. So we really want to try and keep